Hi, my name is Keith Evans. I'm 44 years old. Right now, I stay with my mom. I want to go back to taking care of myself. I don't want to be a burden. The job I was working was, it was a good job. I was working at the Shasta Soda Company as a forklift driver. Back in early 2009, they had to start downsizing because of the economy. They said, well, we don't need you right now. We'll call you when things get a little better. At that time, I had a home, a car, and once you have that set way of living, and then when it's snatched away from you, you panic. And then I had, you know, my girlfriend and her kids, and, you know, like I said, I'm not making any excuses or condoning what I did, but under the pressure, I would like to ask a lot of people, what would you do? You know, when people get depressed, they drink and get high. I said to myself, if I was going to break law to live, I want to commit a crime that doesn't hurt anybody. And what I brainstormed was, look, it's not like I'm pulling out any weapons or anything. So look, you're going to buy my stuff. Without customers, there are no dealers. My sentence was 10 years. I served 4.5. And my conviction was for conspiracy to sell heroin. At that time, I felt as though if I took a little risk on doing that, maybe to get me by until I find another job, which was the wrong way to think. I will never do that again. I was first at Eastern Correctional Center, it's called ECI. I seen a guy get stabbed to death in front of me in the day room. I had 10 years. There was this guy that had 5 years, another guy that had 3 years, and then we was around a bunch of lifers. The people that done violent crimes were more living like they didn't care. They know they're not going anywhere. I have gotten to a point where I turned fear almost into attack. I wouldn't let no one get close to me now because I got stabbed from the back. Now I'm twitching and turning and I can't sleep. I've been out 60 days, you know, roughly 2 months. The reentry is really the toughest part because it's about switching almost different worlds. You know, the world of where you had to survive and live hard and rough. Now you got to be mindful of you're not in that environment anymore. And sometimes it's just hard to hold a regular conversation with a regular person. When do you stop paying penance for your crime? I apply for cleaning jobs, warehouse. And I know it's a must that you must check people's background these days. But if I was an employer and I was saying, you know, if this guy isn't a rapist or a murderer or a threat to myself and the people that work for me, and you know, I would give him a second chance. I mean, seriously, we have people coming in this country illegally and they can get a job faster than I can. Even when parole is over with, it's still going to be tough because I will still have that tag as an ex-con. You know, I just want to be a regular person again. You know, I just want to be a citizen again. Am I asking too much?
Thanks for downloading this week's episode of The Lines Between Us, a weekly series on 88.1 WYPR about inequality in the Baltimore region. I'm Lawrence Lanahan, senior producer for Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Much more at our website, including data maps, opportunities for listeners to join the discussion, and more stories like the one you're about to hear. That's linesbetweenus.org. Now, back to the podcast.
On 88.1, this is The Lines Between Us. I'm Sheila Cast. Earlier this month, Governor O'Malley signed legislation to ban the box on state job applications next to the question, have you ever been convicted of a crime? As of October 1st, the box will not appear on state job applications. For those who fought for the legislative change for 4 years, it means prior convictions will no longer make the first impression on a major employer's initial application. Even with that change, many obstacles confront the thousands of ex-offenders who are released into Baltimore City every year. Obstacles that can sidetrack them on their road from ex-offender to employee. Today, we want to examine some of those obstacles. Joining me now is someone who worked to ban the box. Karen York is the lead policy associate on reentry issues for the Job Opportunities Task Force. Karen York, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheila. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Trina Selden, the executive director of Out for Justice, a nonprofit that organizes ex-offenders and their families in calling for policy and criminal justice reforms. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us from the Northwest One-Stop Career Center, located inside Mondawmin Mall, is Gerald Grimes. He's project manager for the Reentry Center there. Gerald Grimes, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Now, Karen York, can you sort of take us into the hiring process? How will the removal of that box and that question on state job applications, how will that affect ex-offenders?
So before the law passed, the idea behind having the question on the application was that it was not providing individuals an opportunity to get their foot in the door. So ultimately, when you check that box indicating that you've ever been arrested or convicted of a crime, employers and hiring managers were using that as a filtering mechanism to sift through the many applications that they are receiving. So ultimately, when you check that box, that is an indicator that this is a candidate that we don't need to consider. So ultimately, that application was going in the trash can, and individuals were not provided an opportunity to get their foot in the door, be provided an interview based on their merits, so that once in the interview, they can explain any criminal background they have, in addition to any skills that they bring to the position that they are applying for.
So does banning the box change anything for employers?
No, it does not. It absolutely does not. And actually, when you say ban the box, it sometimes can be misleading. You're not banning asking about someone's criminal background. You're really moving the point in time when you inquire into an individual's criminal background.
Now, Trina, you've got some personal experience here. You run a nonprofit, but you are also an ex-offender.
I am.
What were the charges, and how did they affect your effort to find work?
My charges were drug charges, possession with the intent, only because I had a drug habit, and I sold drugs to support my habit. I got incarcerated in 2000, drug charges, and while there, I exhausted all the programs that I could do, and I was in college, you know, I was going to do these.
In prison?
Yes, I was going to do these college courses, give myself a chance, because I never did, you know, the several other times that I got locked up. Scheduled to go back to court in March of 2003. I wrote to the judge, like, you know, I'm still in college. I'm scheduled to graduate in July. I need this certification in human services, you know, if I'm going to give myself a chance. So I opted to stay till July, graduated, 3.7 grade average.
Congratulations. Ooh,
thank you. And when I came home, I wanted to take the certification and run with it and applied for a job at this, I'm not going to say where, working with special need kids. And was told because I had checked that box that my application wouldn't be considered. And that sort of pissed me off to the point of Out for Justice being born.
And so did that kind of thing happen repeatedly?
Lots
other jobs
of times,
you applied to?
Lots of times. And it happened so frequently that I came through a program called Alternative Directions. And that was like a structured program, and went to church house from prison. I did everything that they asked me to do. I did job readiness. I did all these classes, and I still wasn't getting all these jobs. And even though they told me, you know, check this box, it's not going to be a deterrent, you know, whether we hire you or not. Hmm. So I'm checking these boxes, and I'm still getting all these doors shut in my face. I showed up every day at Alternative Directions until they gave me a job.
So Alternative Directions being the parent nonprofit. Gerald, I'm sure Trina's experience is pretty common, that incarceration, previous incarceration, or previous conviction is a disqualifier. You advocate for people coming into the reentry center. How do employers describe their apprehensions to you?
Well, that comes from a number of different factors. Some is statute. Some is legislative statute. In the state of Maryland, depending on your conviction, you won't work with children or the elderly, for instance. So if you desired a job in a daycare and you have a criminal conviction, you can't work there. And that's by statute. But a lot of it is also just personal failings. People still believe in that scarlet letter syndrome. You have a person who has committed a crime, and, you know, I don't want them in my workplace. I don't know what they're going to do, things like that. It's just that kind of fear.
Well, but let me ask about that fear. I mean, something there, I guess real data is hard to find, but there's something like half of ex-offenders do commit crime again. I mean, do employers have something to fear, and is there an intelligent way to approach that?
First and foremost, when somebody commits a crime and they're incarcerated, they do their time. And we tell people, we want you to come out and we want you to become a productive citizen. Well, you have to allow people the opportunity to do that. People are going to survive. People have to survive. And it's a public safety issue. Let's face it, if in fact you're not going to give people the opportunity to make a living, they're going to resort to going back to lives of crime if that's what they're used to. So you have to give people a chance. And I can't tell you how many grown men and women I see every day come to me with tears in their eyes. Mr. Grimes, I did everything they told me to do, and I still can't get a job. You know, I'm trying to be on the straight and narrow. We have got to give people these opportunities.
So how do you persuade an employer that it's his or her responsibility to do that? What case do you make to them?
Folks who are ex-offenders probably make some of the best employees, especially in terms of retention. I mean, the doors have been shut in their face so often that they're very, very grateful that somebody's given them an opportunity, and they work really, really hard trying to maintain that opportunity. There's some wonderful skill sets in people. Everybody who has criminal background issues is not an unskilled, uneducated person.
Witness Trina.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And there are a lot of skills and abilities that can be put to good use if we just give people a chance. Also, that we do have mechanisms that we use as incentives for employers. For instance, there's tax credits, there's a federal bonding program, those sorts of things that make it a little more comfortable for that employer to take a chance on people. But ultimately, we send employers people who have the skills and abilities to do their jobs. And so if you're looking for a productive worker, somebody who can help your business and your business's bottom line, then we want to send them to you so that you can give them a chance at employment.
Karen, where is the line between an employer being overly cautious in assessing risk and out-and-out discriminating against ex-offenders?
I think the line is how they interpret the criminal record. So if you have a prospective employee that is applying for a position, say, a cashier at your local Walgreens, and that particular person has a 5-year conviction for, say, possession of marijuana, the line is, at what point does that conviction for possession of marijuana have any bearing on how that individual is going to perform their job? So when you are using that conviction for possession of marijuana against them in the hiring decision, you're ultimately telling that individual that I believe that you are going to reoffend and that you, you know, have some type of drug problem, so I should not consider you. So the line really is really interpreting that particular criminal record and trying to figure out whether or not the offense has a direct correlation to the job at hand, the time that has lapsed since the offense has occurred, and what has been done during that time that the offense has occurred. Now, if you have an individual who has, you know, repeat offenses one after the other, then understandably the employer is going to pause and require, you know, a higher level of scrutiny.
Last year, the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission updated its guidance on how employers use arrest and conviction records. How has that update affected those with a criminal conviction?
You know, this guidance update, which the EEOC had not updated their guidance on how you use criminal records in the hiring decision for 25 years, this guidance update pretty much states that you cannot use someone's criminal record against them unless the offense is directly related, and you have to take into account the factors that I mentioned before, such as, you know, the time that it's lapsed, how serious the offense. And this was huge because now, you know, advocates and practitioners and the such can say to employers, look, not only does this have a disproportionate impact on individuals with a criminal record, whether they, you know, were incarcerated or whether they just have a criminal record, but it also has a disproportionate impact on people of color. Because people of color, minorities, they're already facing discrimination in the labor market due to the fact that they're African American. But then when you add on this additional factor, such as a criminal record and all the barriers that come along with the criminal record and the social stigma and the economic stigma that comes along with it, then you are effectively shutting out a segment of the population from society and from the economy. And it really just boils down to, you know, an individual's interaction with the criminal justice system should not equate to a lifetime of social and economic disadvantage.
On 88.1 WIPR, this is The Lines Between Us. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Gerald Grimes, project manager for the Reentry Center at the Northwest One-Stop Career Center, with Karen York, policy associate with the Job Opportunities Task Force, and Trina Selden, executive director of Out for Justice. We're talking about employment obstacles faced by ex-offenders. I want to talk about the underlying disparities that ex-offenders go in with. There was a 2010 study by the Pew Center, one of the Pew Centers, found that 37% of African-American men who were incarcerated did not have a diploma or GED. That's about 10 times the percent of incarcerated women who did not have a diploma or GED. I mean, what many ex-offenders didn't have before they went to prison, education, stable housing, work experience, still barriers when they're released. So in this conversation, we're focusing on jobs, but what is the impact of these other needs?
Well, I mean, the impact is immense on families and communities, because if you think about it, these individuals, I'll take Baltimore City, for instance, you have individuals that are coming from these blighted communities and are being incarcerated, and they barely have, you know, some barely have a middle school education, and they're entering into these jails and prisons, and they're returning back to our communities. They are not receiving, they haven't received any skills or any type of vocational skills while incarcerated, or they haven't obtained their GED or finished their schooling. So they're returning back to their communities unskilled and uneducated. They also have this scarlet letter of a criminal record that's also going to continue to be a barrier to accessing employment. It's an insurmountable barrier that a lot of these individuals just feel that they cannot face, they cannot even tackle, so they don't even try to, because they feel that the system is built against them. You know, communities are strong when their residents are working and when they are contributing citizens. But if you have communities full of individuals with criminal records that can't get jobs, and then they owe all this money in child support, and they have all these other fees that are associated with them being incarcerated, then you're not going to have a strong community.
And Trina, given the big numbers, especially in Baltimore, the big numbers of returning ex-offenders, are there places they can go to try to address these needs even before they solve the employment problem, housing, education, that kind of thing?
It's a lot of places to go to get services, but to really just stop it all, I mean...
To solve the problem,
it would be to change the policies, change the legislation, you know, organize around, you know, around the issues, get the people that are directly affected by all of these issues together, take it to Annapolis, and let those legislators and policymakers and those that make decisions see that this is serious, you know.
And another thing I think you want to speak on is that there are programs within the prisons themselves that are getting people prepared. The one thing that I can't do with an employer is send them somebody who is unprepared.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be able to do the job. They have to have the skills. There are many vocational programs in our prisons. They have programs and workshops where they prepare the young men and women and others on just how to interview, how to explain your period of incarceration. Once we prepare them to come out and then they're in society, we need for society at large to take a look at them and say, okay, you've rehabilitated, and we want to give you a chance.
Do you coach your clients on how to explain their past convictions?
Of course we do, and the basic way we do it is to tell them their job interview is not a discussion of their criminal record. We call it the 30-second rule. And the 30-second rule is you want to tell the employer, be open and honest, to say, yes, I did this thing. I regret doing this thing. But do not make that interview an interview about your period of incarceration. Make that interview about your skills and abilities in order to do that job, because ultimately that's what the employer should be looking for.
Trina, I want to get back to recidivism, because there's research that shows that of the numbers of ex-offenders who commit crimes again, and it's a big proportion, maybe not half, but it's a lot. 3 years seems to be 3 years post-release seems to be sort of a danger point when 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 it becomes more likely that an ex-offender will recidivate. What's gone on in those 3 years that makes that the point to worry?
I guess they're coming home. They're doing everything that they can. You know, they're trying to get birth certificates. They're trying to get Social Security cards and everything associated with it. They want to be productive. They want to work. They want to pay taxes. They want to do all of these things. But there's so many barriers that's placed in front of them. If they aren't productive in those first 3 years, they're going to go back to what they know.
What kind of supports helped you most?
Alternative directions, the structure, them holding my hand, I guess, till I was able to stand on my own. Like, they made sure that I had parenting classes. They made sure I had the job readiness. Like I said, I showed up every day. I did get an internship working as a paralegal, legal secretary for a law firm. And after that 90-day internship, they hired me because I was able to do that job.
Mm-hmm. And you had shown that?
I had shown that, and I've been there now, 10 years?
I want to get back to that Pew study I mentioned. It found continuing economic consequences of incarceration, that former inmates work fewer weeks, earn less money, have limited upward mobility, which, of course, upward mobility is one way to say American dream.
Mm-hmm.
40% less earnings on average by incarcerated men than men who had not been incarcerated. So how do you see the possibility of economic mobility for individuals who have been convicted?
Well, if you give them the opportunity for uh-huh. training, if you give them the opportunity to get the things that they need to become upwardly mobile and give them the opportunity to do so, you're going to see those numbers change. But let's go back to another part of the conversation. The risk factors of becoming incarcerated, no education, low skills, those sorts of things, are the same things that people are experiencing coming out. I can't tell you when folks come to this center, just the technology changes that are happening. Folks coming out of prisons can't use computers if they've been in for a while. We have to teach people how to use a computer just to do job search. And if I've been in prison for the last 5 years, I don't know those skills. So we've got to change those skills so that when folks come out, they can get jobs. And then once they get jobs, like everybody else, learning is lifelong. You continue to learn so that you can continue to progress.
I really appreciate you all talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gerald Grimes is the project manager for the Reentry Center at the Northwest One-Stop Career Center at Mondawmin Mall. Trina Selden is executive director of Out for Justice. And Karen York is the lead policy associate on reentry issues for the Job Opportunities Task Force. She'll be joining Tom Hall in a few minutes to continue this discussion about the barriers that ex-offenders face in trying to secure employment. We have more information about Out for Justice, the Job Opportunities Task Force, and the Reentry Center at linesbetweenus.org. I'm Sheila Cass. This is The Lines Between Us. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Marilyn Mornings, The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
Marilyn Morning with Sheila Cast. Welcome back to The Lines Between Us. I'm Tom Hall. Today we're talking about the barriers to employment for those with a criminal record. As we heard in the first half of our show, the impact of a criminal conviction can echo into the future for years. But how long should it follow you? And what should employers and landlords know about your past? Those are the central questions surrounding shielding laws, which keep certain crimes hidden from public view, and expungement laws, which remove them from records completely. We're joined once again by Karen York, who we heard from earlier in the hour. She is policy associate at the Job Opportunities Task Force. Mary Denise Davis joins us as well. She works in Baltimore City's Office of the Public Defender. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
So, Ms. York, let me start with you. You supported a shielding law that failed to pass the General Assembly in this last session. So what would that shielding law have changed from the current law?
Okay, so currently Maryland does not allow the shielding of any criminal convictions. So the shielding law would ultimately allow individuals to petition the court after a certain period of time, after they've completed any supervised probation or any mandatory supervision they had, would allow individuals to petition the court to shield certain nonviolent misdemeanor convictions from public view. So what that means is police officers, the courts, state's attorneys and the such, they would still have full access to shielded records. In addition to law enforcement in the courts, employers with the statutory requirement to run initial background checks, they would have access to shielded records. Entities that service children or have children in their buildings or employ individuals who work with children, who employ volunteers who work with children, they would have full access to shielded records. Health occupation boards, they would have full access to shielded records. The idea is your average Joe could not go on Maryland Judiciary case search and see that you were convicted of possession of marijuana 5-10 years ago and use that against you when you were trying to obtain public housing or employment.
So you mentioned, like, for example, marijuana possession.
Mm-hmm.
This law would have covered 17 different citational offenses. Give me a couple of other examples.
Okay, so possession of marijuana, malicious destruction of property under $500, trespassing on posted property, disturbing the peace, crimes like that. We're not talking about, you know, felonies, crimes of violence, anything that would land you on the sex offender registry.
Mm-hmm.
Things like second degree assault would not have been eligible for shielding.
So, Mary Denise Davis, you work a lot with expungement cases.
Yes.
So that is another route that some people can take. What crimes, what kinds of things can be expunged in Maryland?
When it comes to expungement, the expungement law, it's a question of what the disposition is, and it's the favorable dispositions, the not guilties, the dismissals, the nol process, the stats, and the probation before judgments.
So, for example, you mentioned this nol process. That
mm-hmm.
means that a prosecutor can, you can be charged with a crime, and a prosecutor can choose not to prosecute you.
Yes, they decline to prosecute.
But that would still be on your record. The fact that you were charged would still be on the record, and it only leaves the record if you take the initiative to expunge it.
Yes, there's only one type of scenario. It's a release without charge, which would be eligible to be expunged. It's automatic. Everything else, if you're formally charged, you must take the active step of having it expunged from your record and pay the $30 filing fee, except for the not guilty. In Baltimore City, the most common type of favorable disposition, I would say, is a nol pros, where the state's attorney, you know, doesn't have the evidence, they don't have a witness, so they decide to nol pros the case. What happens is that individual doesn't go and take that step to have it expunged. One of the problems is that the use of criminal records has skyrocketed in the past couple of years. So you have individuals who never were affected by the fact that they had these nol process and stats and PBJs on their records until the use of criminal records started escalating year after year. Everybody started using them.
It's become quite a business. There are a lot of businesses that make these records available.
The private databases. Mm-hmm. So what happened is now individuals are finding that when they go to look for a job, the employer isn't just looking at their convictions. What they're also looking at is favorable dispositions. And every Wednesday at the Park Heights office, I have individuals, I can get anywhere from like 15 to 25, 30 people a day coming in looking to get their record expunged. And what is most frustrating is that the case that is causing the employer the concern is not the conviction, it's the case in which was nol pros. For instance, an individual came in that was charged with attempted murder. The state's attorney nol prosed it because he should never have been charged. That attempted murder charge was like 15 years old. He never thought about it. He didn't think about it because he left out of the court. He thought, hey, it's over with. A couple of years later, he got a driving without a license. And that alone, criminal traffic case, because he was found guilty, paid a fine, didn't even do any time in jail or prison, that conviction locks in. And so now the employer, let's put it this way. Most employers aren't concerned about a driving without a license. They look at the fact that he was charged with this serious felony. And they don't consider the fact that it was a NARPAS. They just see the charge and they make a judgment. And you multiply this by cases. Right now, there's so much focus on public safety. And I understand about public safety, but there's also the concept of why we even have expungement. Because if I receive a favorable disposition, there is a right of privacy. That information, the fact that I was charged with that crime, there is a right of privacy that no one should be able to have access to that information. And the subsequent conviction provision basically, almost in a way, throws out your right to privacy because it's saying you don't have a right to privacy even though you have a favorable disposition. And I think that's really what one thing that really needs to come back into the discussion, not I mean, a conviction is a separate conversation. But when we're talking about favorable dispositions, we really need to be talking about the fact that these individuals, the right of privacy is at stake.
But Ms. York, you know, someone's making a hiring decision. You look at their resume and you say, okay, this person has experience. You're going to ask that person about his or her experience. So shielding basically would say that this criminal experience somehow isn't relevant to the employer. So why isn't it relevant?
Well, I'll put it in this context. If you were applying to be a pharmacist and you had a history of CDS convictions, that's relevant.
CDS means?
Controlled dangerous substance. So just drug convictions, okay? Mm-hmm. That may be relevant for the job at hand. However, if you were convicted for, and I keep using possession of marijuana because of the large number of individuals in the city and the state of Maryland that are arrested and convicted for possession of marijuana. You're convicted for possession of marijuana, years go by, and you are trying to apply as a cashier or any type of low-wage, low-skill position, that conviction is irrelevant to the job at hand. It does not matter that you smoke pot.
So that's the criteria. The criteria is relevance to the job.
Right. That's what our focus was on the shielding legislation, okay? We understand that, you know, employers are worried about liability, and we understand that you want to maintain public safety, but there comes a point in time where certain crimes just should not be taken into account when you are trying to decide whether or not you're going to hire someone. And that's how we tried to come up with the list of crimes. That's why we focused on, okay, nonviolent offenses, because we know that, you know, jails and prisons are just jammed with nonviolent offenders.
On 881, I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to The Lines Between Us. Karen York is Policy Associate at the Job Opportunities Task Force, and Mary Denise Davis is a public defender in Baltimore City. So these shielding laws that take 3 to 5 years to kick in, there's a study by the National Institute of Justice that suggests that if you have a stable job and you're not committing a crime within 3 to 5 years, you are no more a risk of committing a crime again than somebody who's never been in the criminal justice system.
Right.
So it seems that at the very time that ex-offenders need the shielding law the most, which is right when they get out of incarceration, is the time that it's not available to them. So is it helping? I mean, what can be done about that? That seems a conundrum.
That's something that, you know, advocates within the reentry community, you know, struggle with all the time. Because ultimately, the idea is if you've been incarcerated and you've served your time and you've served your parole or probation, that's when you were rehabilitated. So you should not need any additional time to, I guess, cool off or to, you know, show that you are further rehabilitated. However, when you are talking to policymakers and when you are talking to key decision makers and all they are thinking are felons and bad people and criminals, it makes them feel a little better if they can show or if, you know, there's a waiting period. I mean, that's ultimately what it boils down to.
That's a political decision.
It really is a political decision because, I mean, we would love to just say, as soon as you finish your parole or probation, automatically shield it. They're not having that.
Mm-hmm.
You should have to wait an additional time period, and then you should have to go petition the before the courts.
What other states have shielding laws?
So it's kind of tricky because there are about 28 states that have some type of law that restricts public access to criminal records. I can't really say which states have shielding because shielding, expungement, and sealing are used interchangeably depending on what state you're in. So, for instance, you could have a state that has a shielding law, but how they interpret shielding is the way we interpret expungement and vice versa.
So it's hard to compare apples.
It's really
and apples.
Hard to compare. Yeah. But what I can say is that there are states that do allow for, you know, restriction of felonies. Some states would allow you to expunge all felonies, all drug crimes, all misdemeanors. Some allow for the automatic expungement of it. Some only allow for, you know, 1 to 2 waiting periods. I mean, it varies, but it really just shows that
Is there at any point, I know it's early in the process where these shielding laws are not old in any of these places,
mm-hmm.
Is there any data to suggest that there's an impact of these shielding laws on recidivism and crime?
Well, I think that yes. The short answer is yes. There are hosts to show that if you provide these individuals with the opportunity for stable housing and employment, then you're maintaining public safety by dramatically dropping the recidivism rates because there's no need for them to reoffend.
And I would say from my experience, I have direct contact of the clients who mm-hmm. are like desperately in need of having something to do with their record. And sometimes I would just like legislators to come to my office every Wednesday so they can hear their constituents talk about the impact of the expungement law and how harsh it is. But so often it's, I need this off my record because they'll hire me if I can get this off my record. But it's not possible under the law. And then just throw out there about the private databases because you mentioned that. There's no regulation of private databases when it comes to cases that have been expunged. For instance, a state agency, once a case has been expunged, it's a misdemeanor for them to disclose information that has been expunged. However, private databases, once it's in their system, they're not regulated.
They could get it wrong easily.
Yeah. And it is wrong a lot of times.
It is wrong. And some of them even will publish the person's booking photo, and some of them will charge to have it expunged from their private database, even though it's a conviction. So the individual has thought they got their record expunged through a private database, but it turns out it's still on the record.
Well, Karen York and Mary Denise Davis, thank you very much for your time and for your perspective. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Karen York is policy associate at the Jobs Opportunity Task Force. Mary Denise Davis is in the City of Baltimore's Public Defender's Office. We've got more information on our website, linesbetweenus.org. That's it today for our edition of Lines Between Us. I'm Marilyn Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. We hope you have a great holiday weekend.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at wypr.org. Have a great day.